From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn, and Happy New Year. On today's show, the premise of Bird Box is that you can't open your eyes, but everybody is watching the Netflix movie. And just as in Hollywood, it's very hard for women to direct on Broadway, Lee Silverman is one of the few who's broken through.
To have the first all-female creative team on Broadway, which was also shocking in 2018 that is true, but that is to some degree a political act because it is something that has never happened before.
And singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher has a Grammy nomination for her collaboration with military vets. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Aquaman is the big hit at the box office right now, but the movie that everyone's talking about is Bird Box. The Netflix film stars Sandra Bullock as a mother who must protect her children from a monster, all while blindfolded. Though it received average reviews, the film broke viewership records for the streaming service. 45 million accounts streamed it in the first week, according to Netflix. It's also inspired a viral meme and the hashtag #TheBirdBoxChallenge. But it hasn't been all good news for Netflix recently. It has faced heavy criticism for complying with Saudi Arabia's request to pull an episode of Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj that criticized the Saudi government. Dade Hayes is a contributing editor to Deadline, and when we spoke about Netflix news this morning, he started with Bird Box's streaming numbers.
I should note that Netflix never gives any data about anything. So the idea that they are sharing this data is quite interesting, number one. And number two, it really does point to the breadth of the business that they've built just in the last 3 to 5 years.
It is fair to say that Netflix is pretty secretive about its numbers, and that includes other movies that it has released, Roma, Beasts of No Nation, Ballad of Buster Scruggs, War Machine. So why might Netflix be public with this film? Because it does feel like there is a real phenomenon here.
It does seem like they're picking up signals, and they're obviously poring over their extensive data that shows that this is a family title. It has a very recognizable A-list star in Sandra Bullock in the lead. And it has genre elements, but it's not a, hard R kind of title that would scare anybody away. It also culturally seems fairly universal. Sandra Bullock in doing publicity has pointed to this as the ultimate parable for any parent, kind of leading their children while blindfolded, up the river.
Take your blindfold off!
Let's just say they're not hammering nails in that scene. Reviews for the film were mixed to mediocre, and yet audiences can't seem to get enough of it. How important is it to filmmakers to see the numbers that Bird Box is yielding? Because then you could say, actually, maybe more people would see it on a streaming service than if it was in a theater.
I think that was the calculation. I think those numbers are hugely important to see because I think that was what Netflix was thinking, is that, by kind of lifting the veil even a little bit, they are able to show kind of what the scope of the audience is. I mean, if you look at those 42 plus million accounts, if you average it out in the U.S., the average ticket price is $9. It really does point to a theatrical opening week, in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, that's a lot of extrapolating and a lot of, variables in there. But I think it is a huge, huge audience. I mean, they have no intention of turning back. They're really all in on the movie business.
So let's talk about a social media phenomenon that relates to Netflix. And it's something that a few people aren't watching right now. And that's Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj. Here's a clip.
Just a few months ago, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, a.k.a. MBS, was hailed as the reformer the Arab world needed. But the revelations about Khashoggi's killing have shattered that image. And it blows my mind that it took the killing of a Washington Post journalist for everyone to go, oh, I guess he's really not a reformer. Meanwhile, every Muslim person was like, yeah, no He's the crown prince of Saudi Arabia.
So that episode is no longer available in Saudi Arabia. And there are a couple of countries where you can't get Netflix, including China, North Korea, and Syria. What's happening with Patriot Act?
Well, they've obviously had to address the controversy in the region because this is a hot topic. I mean, they don't want to be seen as being insensitive. And this is where localization and local content gets very, very tricky. And movie studios and TV networks have faced this problem over the decades. And now we're seeing it in the streaming world. I think it plays just completely differently to an audience in the U.S. versus an audience in the region. But unfortunately, it's providing some anxious moments and some blowback for Netflix now, because they're backtracking, and they're, you know, that's an uncomfortable position for any company, and especially one that is a tech company that prides itself on being so of the moment and so, you know, on top of the trends. It's definitely a step back for them.
And it's also, I think, an indication of how important foreign markets are. Netflix has been growing its subscriber base. It's probably about 140 million now, but far more than half of those subscribers are people who live outside the United States. So how important are foreign markets? Obviously, Saudi Arabia is not a huge market, but overall, how important are foreign markets to the company's future?
Absolutely crucial to the company's future. I mean, people point to the plateau that they're reaching in the U.S., but the executives are very, very vocal about pointing to all the growth opportunities that remain. Areas like the, you know, Southeast Asia, the Indian subcontinent, Eastern Europe. I mean, they're pretty much everywhere in the world except China. So they really do have a tremendous amount of space to fill in. They're also getting more experienced at local language co-productions, and they get these crossovers like Dark, you know, a German series that actually finds an audience in the U.S. and elsewhere, and Narcos, that's, you know, a lot of their shows have had, you know, subtitles, but they've really, really found a following.
Dade Hayes is a contributing editor at Deadline. Dade, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, John.
In a tweet sent out earlier today, Hasan Minhaj said, quote, "Clearly, the best way to stop people from watching something is to ban it, make it trend online, and then leave it up on YouTube." Coming up, like Hollywood, Broadway is a man's world. Director Lee Silverman is trying to change that.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards for Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Screenplay, and Best Picture of the Year. Also nominated for 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards, 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Best Picture, and one of AFI's 10 Best Pictures of the Year, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Tony Award nominee Lee Silverman has directed a wide range of stage productions that include David Henry Hwang and Jeanine Tesori's Soft Power, the Sutton Foster musical Violet, and her latest project on Broadway, The Lifespan of a Fact, starring Daniel Radcliffe. She's one of the very few women who's had the chance to direct so many high-profile shows, and she's helping advance the cause for other women. The Lifespan of a Fact made Broadway history as Silverman assembled the first show with an all-female creative team. When I sat down with Silverman in New York a few weeks ago, we started by talking about 2 other plays she directed, All the Ways to Say I Love You, which starred Judith Light, and Harry Clark, starring Billy Crudup. Silverman adapted both stage productions for Amazon's audiobook platform, Audible. They're part of the company's new theater division.
One of the great things about, particularly when we recorded Harry Clark, was Billy Crudup has done so much voiceover work, and we had this very theatrical play, and then he and I had to sort of sit down and rethink about how are we going to turn this into something that someone can listen to, and how do we take an evening that's for a couple hundred people and turn it into an extremely intimate experience. And when you listen to Harry Clark, it's like he's right there talking in your ear. And the kind of reconception of how to tell the story to one person inside their ear as opposed to on a stage for many is a really interesting experiment that as a director I never thought I would have.
And how do you work with the Dramatists Guild? Because unlike Hollywood, where screenwriters are basically, you know, put through the chipper,
yes,
and you can do as a director pretty much whatever you want, authors in theater have amazing creative rights,
yes,
and you can't really change his or her text
That's
without
true.
Approval. So how
yes.
do you do that?
Well, I have had the great fortune of working with some amazing dramatists. And for me, because I work so much on new plays, my relationship with the playwright is everything. So I really believe in the collaboration and in the collaborative process, and that they're going to author the text. I'm going to bring to them a visual authorship and an idea for how to translate their words on the page into 3D to the audience in a way that I think is surprising and theatrical. And then we debate it and we talk it out, and they say, oh my God, I never thought of that. That's amazing. I never thought of that. That's horrible. And then we tussle for a while. And my goal is to try and create a vision with this partner.
Is the idea to bring theater to an audience that can't necessarily come to New York or Los Angeles, can't afford a $250 ticket?
Yeah.
So a lot of people who love theater who can't possibly afford it.
Right. I mean, this to me is a really paramount problem of the theater, which is who is it for and who are we making it for and who can afford to see it literally, and how to bring theater to people that otherwise wouldn't be interested or don't think it's for them. And part of it is who we put on the stage and whose stories we're telling. And part of it is cost, and part of it is location. And so these are all issues that I think we're really grappling with right now in the theater, and hopefully we'll be doing better.
You worked on Violet with Sutton Foster and Joshua Henry. And it made me think when I was watching Wild Goose Dreams that those two shows, radically different, are also about something that you seem interested in, and that is marginalization of people based on their appearance and what they look like and how other people see them. Have you ever thought consciously about the themes that you find yourself attracted to?
I hadn't thought of that consciously. I love that you said that. Actually, I feel like that theme does come up a lot in my work, because many of David Henry Hwang's plays, of which I've directed six, are about being a kind of outsider, insider-outsider, not being part of sort of either culture, being part of both cultures as being Asian American, not knowing exactly where your home is, where your North Star is, and certainly Violet. And I feel really interested, and I'm really drawn to the complications of humanity and also our deep, deep desire to connect, because I think that is part of what we go to the theater for, which is to say, like, how can I see my own life and understand myself better through the trials and tribulations of somebody else? How do I learn how to live?
You're working on a play, or just open a play called Lifespan of a Fact, and you were working on that well before, I suspect, Rudy Giuliani said truth isn't truth, and probably around the same time that Kellyanne Conway floated the idea of alternative facts. When you think about what you're working on and how the world changes and changes the way that a story is received, Lifespan of Facts seems, even though it's not about politics, it feels like the world has changed in ways that make it more relevant than you probably ever imagined.
Certainly part of the amazing piece of working on Lifespan was not only the kind of unbelievable dynamic intersection with our current political moment, but also to have the first all-female creative team on Broadway, which was also shocking in 2018 that is true. But that is to some degree a political act, because it is something that has never happened before. And I will just say that we were in previews during the Kavanaugh hearings, and the way the play resonates against the idea of testifying and lies and truth and, okay, Dr. Ford doesn't remember the day, does that mean it's not true, in relationship to all these people say this thing about me so I know it's true, and how to debate truth, to have that rolling around in our brains all day long, and then to come in and see a play which is a polemic about the idea of truth and fact and argument about this one subject. That's an unbelievable intersection.
We're talking with Lee Silverman about her two plays, Lifespan of a Fact and Wild Goose Dreams. A couple of years ago, I was talking with a filmmaker, Zoe Lister-Jones, and she had a movie called Band-Aid.
I love Band-Aid.
And Band-Aid was an all-female crew.
Yeah.
And Zoe Lister-Jones said, it was really hard. It was really hard to find qualified people to be department heads. And that wasn't her problem. That was Hollywood's problem.
Yes.
That these people hadn't been given opportunities. That it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. That if you didn't hire somebody to be a department head, there was no way the next person was going to because they didn't have the credits. So when you're putting together an all-female crew for Lifespan of a Fact, was it important to not only look for people who were women, but also look for people who were female who didn't have credits so that they finally could have one?
Yes. I love that you brought up Band-Aid. I just have to tell you that Zoe and I are working on a musical
adaptation. It has to be a musical.
Yeah.
I was going to pitch it. If you didn't know this movie, I was thinking this would be a great musical.
Yes. No, we are in process working on that musical
weird.
Which is so amazing. Zoe is a genius. I love her. It's so amazing you brought that up. Yes, I will say that what I look for in a team is diversity in the sense that racial diversity, age diversity, experience diversity, life experience diversity, where people are from, because of course I want as many different ideas in a room as possible. And what I felt like was with Lifespan, it's a play written by three white men based on a book written by two white men. That's five white men of a particular age. And I felt like the way to balance that out was to have a creative team that had all women and that were spanned 20 years in terms of age. And two of the five women are women of color. Three of the five have kids under the age of three. And also, I hired the people who I thought would be best for the job. And people similarly, like what you were saying about Zoe, people have said to me, it was just an accident that you hired all women. And I said, no, the accident wasn't that I hired all women. The accident was that was the first time that had ever happened, not that I had hired them. And I do think a kind of consciousness around who's in the room, what kind of work you're making. And I think in theater, in entertainment in general, it's hard because it's a very nepotistic business. You want people in the trenches with you who you know, who you trust. And so the only way to do that is to widen the road as you go.
When you think about how you measure your own success, I mean, in Hollywood, there's, you know, Rotten Tomatoes scores, there's box office grosses, there's legitimate awards like the Oscars, there's illegitimate awards like the Golden Globes.
Yeah.
How do you measure the success of a play that you've directed?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, I guess when writers come to me after I've worked with them once and they say, oh, I have an idea for a new play. This was my second play I'd worked on with Hansel. I'm working right now with Madeline George, who's a writer I've worked with a number of times before. David Wong, who I've done six plays. Janine, who I've done two musicals. Janine Tesori, and who wrote Violet and Soft Power, the music, amazing composer, lyricist. And Lisa Crone, who's I've done four of her plays. When people come back to me and they say, I'm working on a new play, can I send you like the first scene, or can I pitch it to you, or can I take you for a drink and talk to you about it? That to me feels like success, because I think no matter how the play turns out critically, financially, any of those things, none of that matters. Really, what matters is that somebody wants to do it again with you, because it's so hard to do, to make a play, to give birth to this new thing, that if you want to be back in that moment with someone and do it again, it feels to me like kind of the greatest compliment. And I will also say that having the kind of body of work that somebody like you or somebody else can look at and say, here are some themes that I see, here are some ways that I think that you work, that also feels quite amazing, because I think I've done enough that the pattern can emerge for other people. And whereas like I feel like I'm right inside the trees, it's like you can sort of see the forest. And I did something. I don't know. There's something. There will be something left on the other side. And that feels really exciting to me. And I'm very grateful for that.
Lee, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I am on my way.
The Lifespan of a Fact closes on Broadway on January 13th. Coming up, singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher has a Grammy nomination for her collaboration with military veterans.
Strong and strong.
Jesus, don't wait so long to make my face okay.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher brought military veterans and their families into the writing process for her latest album, Rifles and Rosary Beads. NPR music critic Ann Powers says Gaucher's album is, quote, the product of compassion and a call for more compassion at a time when it's needed most. And now Gaucher has a Grammy nomination for Best Folk Album. Libby Dankman, KPCC's veterans and military reporter, spoke with Gaucher and with a wounded service member who says their collaboration helped heal the invisible injuries of war.
Joshua Gertz joined the Army after high school. He had some uncles who served, and he thought college wasn't for him. That was 1999. Fast forward a few years to Gertz driving a truck on his last night of deployment in Iraq.
My vehicle was hit with a roadside bomb, which left me with brain injury and some spinal cord damage. I'm not wheelchair bound, but it makes things difficult.
It was the psychological wounds that nearly killed Gertz. At one point, after returning home to his wife Lisa and two sons in New York, he attempted suicide.
I felt like I was a burden, and it was almost like I wanted my family to be able to laugh again.
Lisa was looking for help when she came across a news article about a nonprofit that pairs veterans with professional songwriters.
Knowing my love for music, she thought it would be something that I would maybe go to.
Rifles and rosary beads, you hold on.
Gertz grew up near Buffalo in a musical family, but he'd never written a song before. And that's common, says Nashville singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher. She's been volunteering as a mentor with Songwriting with Soldiers for about 5 years. The organization holds several retreats a year all over the country. Each veteran produces a song by the end of the weekend. It's free to service members and their partners. Here's Mary Gaucher.
Soldiers are trained not to be vulnerable, but when they come home, they've got to learn it. And part of telling the story is being uncomfortably vulnerable. But that's what songs do.
War of my baby from my breast, now my name in rank.
This year, Gaucher released an entire album co-written with military veterans from the program. The 11 tracks on Rifles and Rosary Beads dig deep into the veteran experience, including stories you may not typically associate with military service. The song Brothers takes listeners to the emotional deployment of a new mom.
Why my face changed my soaking bra, told my body not to feel at all, tried to be like you, what must I do to prove that I'm a brother too?
I learned a lot writing with Megan Cunahan and Brittany Fadd, being the first generation of females in combat. And the mantra that they had to deal with is no special treatment.
Another track was co-written with half a dozen military wives and songwriter Beth Nielsen Chapman, who wrote the monster hit This Kiss for Faith Hill.
Beth and I sat with the wives, and they started to talk about what they called the war after the war.
There's landmines in the living room, and eggshells on the floor. I lost myself in the shadow of your honor and your pain.
They have to serve in silence a lot of the time. And our veterans have told me over and over again, look, the hero here is my wife.
Invisible. The war after the war.
You know, Leonard Cohen said it best, the crack is how the light gets in. We don't connect at our strengths. We connect at our vulnerabilities.
On the first night of the retreat, Josh Gertz came in skeptical. But Gaucher's vulnerable performance convinced him she would be a reliable songwriting partner.
It was just something about her words, being able to express so many complex feelings with such a simple way of saying it.
So they started talking, Gaucher looking for a way to uncover his song.
She said, so, you know, looking back on it, what do you think that one thing that's kind of weighing you down is? And I said, I don't know, who the hell knows?
Looking back now, who the hell knows where the soul of a dead soldier goes?
I was just blown away that it could be that simple. And then once I started opening up and being truly honest with her, I think Mary saw where the true hurt, my true pain was coming from.
That song became Still on the Ride. Instead of dwelling on his own life-changing injuries, Gertz chose to memorialize a fallen friend. Thomas Falk died November 7th, 2000, just before their one-year anniversary in the Army.
I shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be gone. But it's not up to me who dies and who carries on.
I mean, we spent pretty much every second of every day together since the day we joined the Army, and he was family.
My eyes. Me and my guardian angel were still on the ride.
I shouldn't be here. Why him and not me? With all that, I should be the one. And I think from that kind of stemmed the idea that maybe he went first to be my guardian angel and make sure I made it through those things.
Double vision, and my stomach's in my...
Gertz says he works every day to maintain his mental health. He's played harmonica on stage with Mary Gaucher on her Rifles and Rosary Beads tour, and he credits songwriting with soldiers with helping him open up and trust someone else with his story.
It's always going to be there. You just have better training, better tools to deal with it, and more support to deal with it.
I shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be gone.
For The Frame, I'm Libby Denkman.
But it's not up to me who dies and who carries on.
And that's all we have for today. I'm John Horn. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Me.